from across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society Channel, brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society Channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Our lecture tonight is ballooning, as you know. Dr. Janet Folkes, she is a lecturer in aerospace manufacturing at Nottingham University. She's also, that's her daytime job, as it were. She is a balloonist of international repute. She has won many competitions, and she's going to tell us all about it tonight. Janet.
Well, good evening and thank you for coming. My first slide is not to do with ballooning. I just thought I'd mention a little bit about my day job, only to recruit anybody that's got any information on aerospace manufacturing, because I'm always looking for information for my students. But this is part of some of my research. I'm looking at innovative ways of using the water jet. And so we do machining, cutting, drilling, and also coating removal. And one of the reasons I'm mentioning it is because the government's just funding manufacturing. They're trying to get manufacturing research up and going. So we've just been given a project which is worth just under £1 million for water jet research to replace chemical milling on aircraft frames. So that's part of, amongst other things. I do a lot of work for Rolls-Royce as well. That's a composite fuselage taken from the Hawker Beechcraft, which is now Raytheon Business Jet, and they cut the windows out using water jet. And we've got a five-axis machine, so that's my pretty things that I make with this technology. And we do a lot of other stuff, as I mentioned. So that's the water jet. I also work with lasers for something called additive manufacture. Near net shape manufacture is a big thing at the moment as well. And we do laser deposition, which is fun as well. And that was what my PhD was a long, long time ago. It was related to lasers in aerospace. And we just deposit things, that's powder onto, and you can use it for a pair of turbine blades and things like that. And that's titanium compressor blades or building up geometries. And that's a nice lump of titanium built. I think it took 15 minutes to build that. So, and as I mentioned at the bottom, the initiative, which is a strategic advance to affordable manufacturing in the UK through leading environmental technologies, and it's called Samulet. And I think you'll hear some press about that over the next couple of years. So, ballooning. Setting the scene. I want to talk about a bit about hot air and gas balloons, because I think most people here are familiar with the hot air balloons, and some people from the past may have seen gas balloons. We used to have gas balloons in England, but it's very rare to see a gas balloon in England now. Some of the history. The first flight was the Montgolfier brothers, 1783, and the actual flight was from Paris. And then about, I don't know, a few days later, Charles, as in Charles Law, took off in a gas balloon. But the hot air balloon was the first one to take off, and the Montgolfiers have the honor of being the first people to make the balloon for the first flight. I'm into fabric and technology, so I just wanted to mention a bit about what they used. For hot air, they had fabric lined with white paper and then coated with a layer of alum, and this gave fire resistance to this layer. And the thing I read about it was connected by a network of string and held together by about 2,000 knots. The thing was that this was believed to fly by the gas generated by making it very smelly. And so they made the smelliest concoction below the balloon to make it go up. Later on, they discovered it was actually the hot air that made it rise. But so not a very nice place to be around one of these launches in the old days. Then gas balloons, as I said, was a few weeks later, they came up with the gas balloons. And these are the ones that really took off in more sensors than one in the old days. They were the ones that flew longer and better. So there was something called the Aero Montgolfier, and that was made of a combination of different things. But the interesting thing, I had the information that this one was covered with gold beater skin, which was later used in the in the Zeppelins. But anyway, that was some of the background of the fabric of the balloons. So just to say about hot air balloons, this was one of the Great Britain flights. He was in Scotland. And this was made by a guy called James Tytler. And you can see it's a whiskey barrel almost, so it's very Scottish. And apparently he flew this. He didn't fly it very far. And for the information I've got is it went to 350 feet and it flew half a mile. And of course, people were still not sure what the effect of flying in a balloon or flying at altitude had on people. So he said it was most agreeable with no giddiness. Also, apparently he was wearing a cork jacket for protection. So anyway, it's some very interesting ballooning history, but I won't go into that in great detail. All to say that these balloons really didn't last very long. They caught fire. They couldn't go very long distances. So in those days, the gas balloons really became more popular. And it wasn't until we got to the 1955 when this person, who's the person on the left of your screen, was a guy called Ed Yost. The guy on the right is a guy called Joe Kittinger. I don't know if anybody knows Joe Kittinger, but Joe jumped out of a balloon, actually, at over 100,000 feet. And set the highest parachute jump ever, and it still is the highest jump today. And he did it as part of the validation to see whether before you went into space. So it was a jump as part of those seeing if people would survive from going up from 100,000 feet and bailing out. Anyway, Ed Yost in 1955 came up with a prototype where he put basically not Bunsen burner, but something like that underneath a hot air envelope. And he made the first free flight in 1960. And then he crossed the English Channel 3 years later. So roll on a good 40 years. And we now have balloons, and this was just to mention, I don't know how many people but balloons are regulated and they are certified aircraft. So we have G numbers and we fly on G numbers. And they're manufactured and inspected to various civil aviation and now EASA standards. So the balloon factories have to have the control, not quite as stringent as the aerospace manufacturers for engine parts, but we have to have the same traceability, etc. Pilots have an CAA or now European issued license. We have exams, flight test, and a solo. And the exams are very similar to the PPL exams, except we do balloon systems instead of whatever you do for your aircraft systems. Safety factors are higher than in conventional aircraft. Material and heat, we take things into different accounts on that. And also we have a G loading on landing is also addressed. There is a test that they do with the baskets to look at the G loading on landing, which of course we don't have much G loading, of course, but apparently they throw it off at, I think it's a 6-foot wall or something, and if it survives, which it usually does, then that's their test done. Just to go into it as well, that's a general assembly drawing of a hot air balloon. And it's all regulated, and that drawing is filed with the CAA and authorized. So just to give you some idea. There's lots of technology involved, and we're not talking about hot air tonight, so I just thought I'd show you some pretty pictures. My students are going to be doing some work on the burner. There's a lot of noise issues with cows running around with the burner because there's a high-frequency sound that comes out, which dogs can hear. So every time a balloon flies over, you'll find that the dogs keep barking, but we can't hear it. So, and that's to do with the flame and everything. And there's a lot of technology that goes on with the burner design. The top is what they call a parachute. It's like basically a valve in the top, and you can let out hot air from that. So, and that's just some more pretty pictures of a balloon being deflated. And I just had fun with the thermal imaging camera. And Nottingham have now got one. So, and that's what they look like in practice. So this is what you get if you want to buy a hot air balloon. They come up with some rendering of what your balloon will look like. So that's the University of Nottingham, which is the balloon I fly. And this is what I enjoy doing. This is flying in the Alps. As you can see, it looks pretty much like the drawing does, so that's really good. And the university were very pleased with it because it is quite an impressive logo. That's me flying in the Alps. I was in the balloon, so unfortunately you can't see me. I have one of that, but absolutely amazing to fly hot air. And this event is every January. And we go to a place called Chateau Day, which is in the valley just down from Gstaad, and fly up the valley and across, hopefully, into the different valleys around. And that's a picture of the university balloon. I think that's Lake Geneva to the right-hand side. And just some more views. And I think there was a ski resort below. We went about, I don't know, you have to give clearance in mountains, and so we could still see the people and hear them on the ground. And that's just a pretty picture of some of the trees with the snow on it and the river going down. We also have special shaped balloons, so and that's what the valley looks like. So if you go to Chateau Day in January, hopefully you'll see that sort of view. Don't know how many familiar, if anybody lives near Bristol, quite often we have special shaped balloons down there. Sometimes these land in fields near you, but if Don Cameron was here, he could tell you all about the engineering that goes involved in design of these special shapes. And I always think it's funny to see a mouse flying in the mountains with you. So, and one of my friends flies a birthday cake, and I'm always impressed wherever he goes. I just see him heading off into the horizon and thinking, I wouldn't go there in a normal balloon, and there he is in this cake. So the special shapes aren't that difficult to fly, but packing them up is the real issue. So there's also something called one-man balloons, and this is me in a Russian spacesuit. I went to 7,000 feet in this balloon, but I didn't go to space in it. This one, they just launched this balloon, and they wanted some pictures to show that it was a cutting-edge technology or something. So that's me in that balloon. There you go. And the good thing about these ones is that you can put them in the back of your car, or you can thumb a lift home and get your car and put them in the car. You don't need a trailer and a lot of crew for those. So you can have like a his and her balloon if you want to in your family. So. And that's me flying over Oswestry in Shropshire. Absolutely beautiful day. Flying is wonderful. And countryside is absolutely amazing on these cold winter days. So again, hot air and gas balloons. So moving on to gas balloons. Well, there's three types of gas balloon. Pure gas, Rosio, which is a combination balloon, and super pressure balloons. I'm not going to mention super pressure. It's a specialized field, and the stresses in the fabric need to be really accounted for in those. Gas balloons, well, in England, the first flight in a gas balloon was really by this guy Lunardi, and he took off from London, and I think he landed near South Mimms.
From across the globe. From the center of aerospace. And now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society channel, brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPermedia. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Our lecture tonight is ballooning, as you know. Dr. Janet Folkes, she is a lecturer in aerospace manufacturing at Nottingham University. She's also, that's her daytime job, as it were. She is a balloonist of international repute. She has won many competitions, and she's going to tell us all about it tonight. Janet.
Thank you. Well, good evening and thank you for coming. My first slide is not to do with ballooning. I just thought I'd mention a little bit about my day job, only to recruit anybody that's got any information on aerospace manufacturing, because I'm always looking for information for my students. But this is part of some of my research. I'm looking at innovative ways of using the water jet. And so we do machining, cutting, drilling, and also coating removal. And one of the reasons I'm mentioning it is because the government's just funding manufacturing. They're trying to get manufacturing research up and going. So we've just been given a project which is worth just under £1 million for water jet research to replace chemical milling on aircraft frames. So that's part of, amongst other things. I do a lot of work for Rolls-Royce as well. That's a composite fuselage taken from the Hawker Beechcraft, which is now Raytheon Business Jet, and they cut the windows out using water jet. And we've got a five-axis machine, so that's my pretty things that I make with this technology. And we do a lot of other stuff, as I've mentioned. So that's the water jet. I also work with lasers for something called additive manufacture. Near net shape manufacture is a big thing at the moment as well. And we do laser deposition, which is fun as well. And that was what my PhD was a long, long time ago. It was related to lasers in aerospace. And we just deposit things, that's powder onto, I mean, you can use it for a pair of turbine blades and things like that. And that's titanium compressor blades or building up geometries. And that's a nice lump of titanium built. I think it took 15 minutes to build that, so. And as I mentioned at the bottom, the initiative, which is a strategic advance to affordable manufacturing in the UK through leading environmental technologies, and it's called Samulet. And I think you'll hear some press about that over the next couple of years. So, ballooning. Setting the scene. I want to talk about a bit about hot air and gas balloons, because I think most people here are familiar with the hot air balloons, and some people from the past may have seen gas balloons. We used to have gas balloons in England, but it's very rare to see a gas balloon in England now. Some of the history. The first flight was the Montgolfier brothers, 1783, and the actual flight was from Paris. And then about, I don't know, a few days later, Charles, as in Charles Law, took off in a gas balloon. But the hot air balloon was the first one to take off, and the Montgolfiers have the honor of being the first people to make the balloon for the first flight. I'm into fabric and technology, so I just wanted to mention a bit about what they used. For hot air, they had fabric lined with white paper and then coated with a layer of alum, and this gave fire resistance to this layer. And the thing I read about it was connected by a network of string and held together by about 2,000 knots. The thing was that this was believed to fly by the gas generated by making it very smelly. And so they made the smelliest concoction below the balloon to make it go up. Later on, they discovered it was actually the hot air that made it rise. But so not a very nice place to be around one of these launches in the old days. Then gas balloons, as I said, was a few weeks later, they came up with the gas balloons. And these are the ones that really took off in more senses than one in the old days. They were the ones that flew longer and better. So there was something called the Aero Montgolfier, and that was made of a combination of different things. But the interesting thing, I had the information that this one was covered with gold beater skin, which was later used in the in the Zeppelins. But anyway, that was some of the background of the fabric of the balloons. So just to say about hot air balloons, this was one of the English, this first English, sorry, Britain flight. He was in Scotland. And this was made by a guy called James Tytler. And you can see it's a whiskey barrel almost, so it's very Scottish. And apparently he flew this. He didn't fly it very far. And for the information I've got is it went to 350 feet and it flew half a mile. And of course, people were still not sure what the effect of flying in a balloon or flying at altitude had on people. So he said it was most agreeable with no giddiness. Also, apparently he was wearing a cork jacket for protection. So anyway, some very interesting ballooning history, but I won't go into that in great detail. All to say that these balloons really didn't last very long. They caught fire. They couldn't go very long distances. So in those days, the gas balloons really became more popular. And it wasn't until we got to the 1955 when this person, who's the person on the left of your screen, was a guy called Ed Yost. The guy on the right is a guy called Joe Kittinger. I don't know if anybody knows Joe Kittinger, but Joe jumped out of a balloon, actually, at over 100,000 feet. And set the highest parachute jump ever, and it still is the highest jump today. And he did it as part of the validation to see whether before you went into space. So it was a jump as part of those seeing if people would survive from going up from 100,000 feet and bailing out. Anyway, Ed Yost in 1955 came up with a prototype where he put basically a, like not Bunsen burner, but something like that underneath a hot air envelope. And he made the first free flight in 1960. And then he crossed the English Channel three years later. So roll on a good 40 years. And we now have balloons, and this was just to mention, I don't know how many people you know, but balloons are regulated and they are certified aircraft. So we have G numbers and we fly on G numbers. And they're manufactured and inspected to various civil aviation and now EASA standards. So the balloon factories have to have the control, not quite as stringent as the aerospace manufacturers for engine parts, but we have to have the same traceability, etc. Pilots have an CAA or now European issued license. We have exams, flight test, and the solo. And the exams are very similar to the PPL exams, except we do balloon systems instead of whatever you do for your aircraft systems. Safety factors are higher than in conventional aircraft. Material and heat, we take things into different accounts on that. And also we have a G loading on landing is also addressed. There is a test that they do with the baskets to look at the G loading on landing, which of course we don't have much G loading, of course, but apparently they throw it off at, I think it's a 6-foot wall or something, and if it survives, which it usually does, then that's their test done. Just to go into it as well, that's a general assembly drawing of a hot air balloon. And it's all regulated, and that drawing is filed with the CAA and authorized. So just to give you some idea. There's lots of technology involved, and we're not talking about hot air tonight, so I just thought I'd show you some pretty pictures. My students are going to be doing some work on the burner. There's a lot of noise issues with cows running around with the burner because there's a high-frequency sound that comes out, which dogs can hear. So every time a balloon float flies over, you'll find that the dogs keep barking, but we can't hear it. So, and that's to do with the flame and everything. And there's a lot of technology that goes on with the burner design. The top is what they call a parachute. It's like basically a valve in the top, and you can let out hot air from that. So, and that's just some more pretty pictures of a balloon being deflated. And I just had fun with the thermal imaging camera. And Nottingham have now got one. So, and that's what they look like in practice. So this is the what you get if you want to buy a hot air balloon. They come up with some rendering of what your balloon will look like. So that's the University of Nottingham, which is the balloon I fly. And this is what I enjoy doing. This is flying in the Alps. As you can see, it looks pretty much like the drawing does, so that's really good. And the university are very pleased with it because it is quite an impressive logo. That's me flying in the Alps. I was in the balloon, so unfortunately you can't see me. I have one of that, but absolutely amazing to fly hot air. This event is every January, and we go to a place called Chateau Day, which is in the valley just down from Gstaad, and fly up the valley and across, hopefully, into the different valleys around. So. And that's a picture of the university balloon. I think that's Lake Geneva to the right-hand side. And just some more views. And I think there was a ski resort below. We went about, I don't know, you have to give clearance in mountains, and so we could still see the people and hear them on the ground. And that's just a pretty picture of some of the trees with the snow on it and the river going down. We also have special shaped balloons, so and that's what the valley looks like. So if you go to Chateaudet in January, hopefully you'll see that sort of view. I don't know how many familiar, if anybody lives near Bristol, quite often we have special shaped balloons down there. Sometimes these land in fields near you, but if Don Cameron was here, he could tell you all about the engineering that goes involved in design of these special shapes. And I always think it's funny to see a mouse flying in the mountains with you. So. And one of my friends flies a birthday cake, and I'm always impressed wherever he goes. I just see him heading off into the horizon and thinking, I wouldn't go there in a normal balloon, and there he is in this cake. So the special shapes aren't that difficult to fly, but packing them up is the real issue. So there's also something called one-man balloons, and this is me in a Russian spacesuit. I went to 7,000 feet in this balloon, but I didn't go to space in it. This one, they just launched this balloon, and they wanted some pictures to show that it was a cutting-edge technology or something. So that's me in that balloon. There you go. And the good thing about these ones is that you can put them in the back of your car, or you can thumb a lift home and get your car and put them in the car. You don't need a trailer and a lot of crew for those. So you can have like a his and her balloon if you want to in your family. So. And that's me flying over Oswestry in Shropshire. Absolutely beautiful day. Flying is wonderful. And countryside is absolutely amazing on these cold winter days. So again, hot air and gas balloons. So moving on to gas balloons. Well, there's three types of gas balloon. Pure gas, Rosio, which is a combination balloon, and super pressure balloons. I'm not going to mention super pressure. It's a specialized field, and the stresses in the fabric need to be really accounted for in those. Gas balloons, well, in England, the first flight in a gas balloon was really by this guy Lunardi, and he took off from London, and I think he landed near South Mimms at one point in his flight, and I remember he dropped off a cat en route. I'm not sure why. I think the cat in the basket wasn't very happy or something. I think it was fighting with a dog, actually. And in those days, you know, they really didn't know. They thought the air was like the river, so they thought oars would help them fly and move around. And they really weren't sure what happened to people, so they kept on taking these animals, doing like animal testing nowadays for space flight. And they took a pigeon, a dog, and a cat, and all of them survived, except the cat wasn't very happy. So. And always, you know, drinking while flying. Well, everything I hear about the old days, they were always flying with alcohol. They were always drinking champagne or something in there. And Lunardi was no exception. So he became very cold, and so he found it necessary to take a few glasses of wine. Anyway, he became famous because he had done this wonderful exploit. And this is a picture of the balloon, which is in the Pantheon in London. So moving on to 1975, there was a bit more going on, and gas balloons became accepted. And there was one particular flight of Blanchard and Jeffries, which went across the channel from Dover to Calais. And there's lots of interesting stories about this flight. I don't know how many are true. Jeffries apparently put up the money for it, I believe, and Blanchard then decided that he didn't really want Jeffries on board, so I think I spelled Jeffries wrong. So he tried to kick him out, but Jeffries wasn't having anything of it. Anyway, they got towards the French coast, and according to the story, they needed to throw out lots of ballast, and they ran out of ballast, so they needed to throw out their clothes as well. So they landed almost as naked as the trees by the time they got to the other side. Then we have Pilot de Rosier. He became the first ballooning victim, and he attempted to cross the channel in an aero-Montgolfier, which was this combination of the hot air and the gas. The problem was, in those days, they didn't have helium, so he used hydrogen, and unfortunately exploded, and he got killed. But it's after him and that concept, because his concept was sound. It was just, unfortunately, the hydrogen didn't like having the flame below it. And those became the round-the-world balloons. So round-the-world balloons, advent of helium, became the Rosier design. And because you now, in a gas balloon, you have sand, and when you run out of sand, that's the end of the flight. In Rosiers, you use the burner, and that you don't need to ballast then. And, just to show you, two of the round-of-the-world pilots, the people that made the round the world flight. I don't have, which is Brian Jones and Bertrand Piccard. I don't have a photograph of them, but on the right-hand side, Steve Fawcett. On the left-hand side, Per Lindstrand. And they're doing some test flying. And that's the typical, how a typical Rosier balloon would work. You'd have the gas cell at the top and the hot air cell at the bottom, and you have a burner. So at night, you'd use the burner to keep the hot air cell warm. And that's to give you some sort of scale of those things. They're really quite large scale. And there's a lot of technology behind them, and I'm not going to talk about that technology because I really want to talk about my flight to Spain this year, or last year. But that's the hot air welder. The seams are welded using hot air welding. And all these machines I spec'd and scoped for the company. I was working there. And I think within 6 months of not having any of these machines, we got the machines in, validated them, got them approved by the CAA, and got the aircraft built, which was quite a feat. And I didn't sleep much. Tensile testing machine, again, we bought this in, and it had an environmental chamber so we could test those seams in it. This is a helium sniffer, which was specially built for this project. I talked to somebody who had a mass spectrometer, and they said that they could probably make it. So we made sure that every seam was gas tight. And we didn't want Richard Branson coming down in the middle of the sea, so that's why we ended up doing this technology. All the electronics and everything was tested in an altitude chamber. And you sometimes need to be able to see inside, so there was also a transparent housing made for that chamber. So there's a lot of technology that went into that round the world project. Some of it knocked on and is knocked onto the Beagle lander. They ended up making some of the landing bags for that and some of the technology. Cargo lifter airship, we also did some testing of the fabric for that. And there's a lot of spin-off things that they make today, like inflatable buildings in the company. So I can give you another talk about that another time. And inflation and pressure test, a bit like an aircraft fuselage get pressure tested, balloons get pressure tested, and this is the around the world being pressure tested in Cardington aircraft hangar. So, gas balloons. Gordon Bennett. I don't know if anybody knows much about this, but the Gordon Bennett is the oldest air race in the world that's still running, I believe. It was started in Paris in 1906, and it had 200,000 spectators watching the takeoff. And it's a gas balloon race where the longest distance wins, and it's the Great Circle. Now, as a balloonist, this is the race you aspire to fly in. So this is, when I was, just got my license, this was the one I wanted to do. But you have to get a gas license, not a hot air license, to compete in this race. And getting a gas license in England is very difficult because at the time, there wasn't any gas examiners. So there was one, but he had just died and they hadn't appointed another one, so. The name, well, it comes from James Gordon Bennett. James Gordon Bennett was the son of the New York Herald. His father founded the New York Herald, and James Gordon Bennett took over in 1866 and inherited his multi-million dollar estate. But he was also very good as well, and he was the one that sponsored Stanley to go and find Livingstone in Africa. I think it was Africa. He led a very playboy type lifestyle, but he was big into sports, and especially if they were expensive and not sexy, but sort of a bit like sailing or ballooning or motor car racing. And motor car racing in 1906 was just beginning. So he became a sponsor of these events, and he also, the Isle of Man Bennett Trophy races are well known, and there's a trials course named after him on the Isle of Man. Anyway, from what's important to me is that he inaugurated this long-distance balloon race, and it became the International Gordon Bennett Gas Balloon Race. As an aside, and it's not—it's sort of related—was also the formation of the Royal Aero Club, which I don't know if anybody knows about. But basically, apparently, Frank Hedges Butler and Charles Rolls and his daughter, sorry, and Vera Butler in those days, went for a proposed motor tour, but fortunately her car caught fire, so they decided that they would go for a balloon flight instead, and they went with Stanley Spencer, and they decided to form the Royal Aero Club after this flight. And because Vera was there, they let women into the Royal Aero Club, which was in those days very unusual. But after that, Charles Rolls was very, I guess he then ended up liking ballooning. And so he competed, well, he flew quite a lot of gas ballooning, but he then ended up competing in the very first Gordon Bennett gas balloon in Paris. And he came third, landing in Hull. So that's the connection between Rolls and gas ballooning. So just to mention, I've talked a lot about gas ballooning, but what is it? Well, this is the Retrieve in the old days. In 1896, the Royal Engineers were packing up a balloon and putting on their horses. So, present, well, that's my old car and the trailer on the back. So that's sort of what it looks like, landing in the field in France on this particular one. You need lots of kit. And for this Gordon Bennett gas balloon race, because it's a long distance balloon race, then they ask you to take some of the safety things that you wouldn't normally carry on a flight. So in the foreground, we've got a life raft. And in the foreground, we've also got the blue bucket. So for long distance flying, I won't go into what the bucket's used for, but it will answer any questions anybody's got later. We've also got oxygen and masks, and that's a ELT and also an EPIRB. I think we took both on this last flight. So, and they're for emergency locator transmitter. So if you ditch somewhere, you can send them off and it will send out to the right frequency to get the rescue services to you. And they're taken on board as safety. We also have some food and water and ready-made meals and wonderful designer clothes. So, in a hot air balloon, it's usually quite warm, but a gas balloon at night gets obviously quite cold because we don't have the burner. So, you also need to be lightweight. So the person I was with there was Anne Rich. Anne doesn't have a gas balloon license, but she could fly with me because she flies aeroplanes and she has a hot air balloon license. So she came with me. Here we have these two, and those guys couldn't get off the ground at all because they're too heavy. I went to 22,500 feet in that balloon, and it's the same balloon. So it just gives you an idea of like weight balance and what you can do with it. So I was on my own, of course, and I'd got a weight advantage over them. So we can also read maps. There's a lot of map reading involved, and there's a lot of RT and negotiation with airspace as well. So just proving that we can read maps. Sand, yes, we do have sandbags. I've got a nice video of filling of sandbags, so if anybody wants to do that, then they're always welcome. There's also the basket. That's the sort of basket you have, and what they call the load ring. The load ring connects the basket to what we call the envelope, which is the top bit. So. And, of course, you're flying in an international race, and we're representing Great Britain, so you have to have the British flag. And why go small? We go big. We like a big flag. And it's actually very useful because sometimes you can't see who's which balloon. But believe me, with that flag, they know which balloon it is. So. Fillings with hydrogen. Helium's very expensive. And quite often, most of these races are on hydrogen. Sometimes they're run on helium because if the hosting country has fire regulations or there's problems with that, but most often it's hydrogen, especially nowadays with the economics as they are. So. And that's what a typical gas balloon inflation launch field looks like. Lots of preparation, lots of balloons around and things. And I've got some more slides coming up on that. So, and you can just see the fill hose there. So that's coming from the tanker into the balloon. And there's certain fields in Germany where you go and the actual pipe hydrogen into the center of the field and then take off to the different balloons around it, which was always good except for if somebody's smoking around. So they do ban smoking. So there's a couple of different types of balloons, but this is a traditional old gas balloon, which is netted. And there's certain advantages in this, but for the Gordon Bennett, you want a balloon that's the lightest weight possible so you can go as far as possible, because if you have a heavy balloon, then you take less sand with you. And here we're trying to fly the longest distance, so if you take more ballast, the chances are you can go further. So that's a netted gas balloon, and there's transferring the weight from the envelope to the basket is the critical point. And if we have what we call a balloonmeister to help us with that. So, and the balloonmeister's job is not to lose the balloon, because you could lose the balloon at that stage. And Giles Kaplan's in the audience is a very good balloonmeister. So. And that's what the launch site looks like, typical for launch. So there you go. And just some more pretty pictures just to show you. And this race, this wasn't the one I've just flown in, but this was my balloon here. And I own that balloon. And it sits in a garage in Germany most of the time. And I also own one of these balloons as well. I get them secondhand, don't worry. This is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And here we filled in on helium because this particular fabric is a very lightweight balloon and very competitive. Unfortunately, you can't use on hydrogen because it generates a lot of static. It's one of the new materials. So my aim is to find a lightweight material that's good for hydrogen. And in this balloon, I actually flew 2,400 kilometers to Canada from Albuquerque. Just pre-filled. And takeoff can be day or night. Typically in the Gordon Bennett, it's night. And one thing in this photograph, we have a big bucket here, but I had a male co-pilot. Here we have a tracker, and that tracker sends a signal back. We're not allowed to tamper with that at all, and that's how the race gets recorded. This was the high split forecast for this particular race on the day in 2005 from Albuquerque. So we took off here, and we did actually track pretty much up here. We landed somewhere around there in Canada, which is quite a nice flight. And again, another story. Weather maps, we're always doing this sort of forecasting and looking at the weather. And so that's what sort of weather maps we get. And just to say that this year's Gordon Bennett is going to be in Bristol, and it's the first time ever it's been in the UK. And that's because England won it in 2008. And it used to be every year, so that if you won it the previous year, you host it the next year. But they've decided, because it costs so much money now, to give the host country 2 years. So David Hempelman Adams won it by going the furthest distance in the Gordon Bennett in 2008. So England's hosting it. And it's going to be the first ever Gordon Bennett gas balloon race held in the UK. It's on September the 25th. It's a Saturday night. And it's organized by a committee which is authorized by what we call the British Balloon and Airship Club, the BBAC. So it should be spectacular if you can get to go and see it. Just to show you, flying from England, you can get forecasts which can go interesting places. So I've always wanted to go to Russia in a gas balloon, but I haven't made it yet. And Russia is closed usually for Gordon Bennett. And what they can do is, using this model, we can predict where you're going to go if you go at certain heights and do different trajectories. So I'd like to talk to you about the Gordon Bennett in Geneva this year, well, 2009. And this is the flight that I've just done. Again, there's a high-split model, and this was the competition area as well. So the interesting part here is, this is Africa, and it's out of bounds. And you can see here, if you can avoid this area, you can go to Turkey. So when you look at this forecast, if you take the low-level route, you'll end up sort of wandering down here. If you take the middle route, you'll come this way. And if you take the high-level route, you could get to Turkey if you really sort of try. So some of the balloonists decided to do different things, and it was just later on the strategy. I'll tell you how it goes in a minute. So you need lots of support. So that's us. It's in Geneva. We're sitting there trying to decide what to do. We did have a ground crew back in England who I could phone up to get some weather advice, because trying to get on the internet when you're in a balloon is almost impossible. And if you can phone somebody up that's on the internet and can sort out the weather and filter it for you, it saves a lot of time. So this is the launch field in Geneva. Again, nice green field, and we weren't allowed to drive on there. We just had to carry pull the trailer on there, dump the things out of the balloon, and that's ready. That's the preparation. It's laid out, ready to fill. This is what they call a quick fill. It's different to the netted balloons. So this one just fills by putting the hydrogen in, and it will go upright immediately. There's the fill hose ready. The netted balloons get filled first because they take longer. We're waiting for our turn because the pipeline can't fill everything at once, so you have to wait for your turn. And the only interesting thing is, in these balloons, they don't have the traditional valve that the old netted balloons have. We have what they call a parachute valve here. And that's basically a hole in the top of the balloon, and it's actually sealed by the pressure of the gas inside it. And there have been some interesting bits about the design because, of course, these balloons don't often fly for 3 or 4 days. They go for normally an hour's flight or, goes for a 4 hour or a 10 hour flight. What they did discover with one of these balloons was that they went for a long flight and the pressure didn't keep that valve sealed. So when they got to about 2 days into the flight, the balloon started leaking because that pressure wasn't high enough on that balloon. So they had to redesign it. It works now, I can testify. Inflation starts, so that's the helium hydrogen going in. Then it fills up, and there is a video clip on YouTube, which I'll give you a reference to at the end, and you can see how this inflation goes from being horizontal to vertical. So it goes from being that, and it just flicks up to being like that. And that's a picture of it being almost full. And that's ready to go. And it also on this one, if you notice, what we call appendix, there's a hole here. This is the filling. We've not closed it, but we've just sort of half sealed it. We've pulled it up to stop the air mixing into it. But when you take off, you have to make sure that's open because they've filled them completely. As the balloon goes up, the gas expands and it will come out of the bottom. So in the old, sometimes if that sticks, then you can have your balloon explode, which is the last thing you want. So. There's a few, well, your Bloommeister will make sure when you're taking off that that is open, and you do as a pilot as well. There's some more pretty pictures from the launch site. Beautiful weather, beautiful day. We're very fortunate. I hope we get the same in England. That's Anne and I. That's the photograph on the flyer. We've got so many sandbags on there just because we're not going to fly with all of those, but we have to keep the balloon stable during the day. There's gusts going around, and the sand adds extra stability. That's the sand holder. We really do fly by just throwing sand out. That's all we do. To come down, we vent the hydrogen or helium, and that's how we fly. Radio, transponder, battery, and oxygen. We have to fly with all of those, and unfortunately, they're not pre-installed like they are in aircraft, so we're always making sure they work. So. And the carrying batteries for this is actually one of the and solar panels to try and, because you want lightweight, you don't want to carry too many batteries, and you want to be able to recharge in flight. So that's the bed, so and a backup radio, an ICOM backup handheld. Oh, and just go back to that one. That there is a flap, and the flap means that you can put your feet out and lie flat along here. So it was very comfortable. It's the final briefing, so it's 8 o'clock in the evening. Everybody's there, and that's David Hemelman Adams. He was the person that won it, the right to have it in England. He won it 2 years ago. First English person to ever win the Gordon Bennett. And he's a very famous explorer. This, you can see Geneva's got very nice weather, so we've got 4 knots in Geneva, so in perfect launch conditions. We're going to go to Marseille and Montélimar, 30 knots, 38 knots, so not quite so good down there. And they were saying that the Rhone Valley had got a Mistral in it, so it was just developing but wasn't going to be fully developed when we flew. So we decided to fly that trajectory down the Rhone Valley, ending up to be near Marseille in the morning. And they said it shouldn't be too windy near Marseille. That was the site at night. More pictures. Anne in her wonderful designer suit. And this is, we use this eventually as a sun shield, because during the day it actually gets very hot in the balloon. So, and almost takeoff time. And this was takeoff. So we took off at 11 o'clock in the evening on Saturday the 5th of September. I'll just play you a quick video. Yeah. Oh, no. Maybe I won't play you the video clip. Maybe we'll do it at the end. I can't see. No, okay, I'll do the video clip at the end, sorry. Geneva by night. Absolutely beautiful. After all the preparation, taking off and flying is amazing. And believe it or not, next morning, we had an eventful night going through Grenoble and over some other Lyon airspace and everything. And we came down this valley here, and we aimed to come out here. And we have a decision here that we don't want to land. Well, we have to decide whether we're going to land or fly through the next day. And we were in good shape to go out to sea, but you have to make sure that you are in good shape to go out to sea, have enough ballast, have enough food, the balloon's not leaking and things. So we had a decision whether to land, and notice there's a wind farm here, which is always not a very good place to land near wind farms, normally. But anyway, we decided to carry on out to sea. That was a sunrise over the French coast, so we could land, but we decided that if we are going out to sea, we've spoken to our Met people, and they say we should be able to get back into land. It'll be slow over the sea, but we should be able to get there. And that's just another pretty picture. And the decision, this is the final point. When we get to here, we can't really go out or no. And that was a Swiss balloon that was quite near us as well. And they went out to sea too. So this was our last view of the coast near Béziers, 8 o'clock on the Sunday morning. And that's where the star is there. And as you can see, we then spent we've come down the Rhone Valley and then going out to sea, we decided to go out to sea. And we spent the next 1.5 days getting back into land. But it's Sunday, so we had Sunday lunch, so that's the Lancashire hot pot. And how we do it is we have a heater pack and it heats up. We put water on this pack and that heats up whatever's inside that bag. So, and not quite the Sunday roast. Sunday evening, we're still over the sea. Nice sunset and lots of boats below. And it's very nice because it was warm over the Mediterranean. And we're slightly comforted by the fact the Mediterranean Sea is a warm sea compared to the North Sea. So, at the time, we didn't know that the race was developing. And in hindsight, what happened was that these three decided to go in the Rhone Valley a bit lower than we did. We decided to keep above the Mistral because we want to keep out of the turbulence of it. I was told by that balloon there, the Austrian balloon, that he had, I think it was 100 kilometers an hour he was doing at night down the Rhone Valley. And that's why these guys are actually way ahead. They were very fast down that Rhone Valley. The only problem was that they were too fast and they missed this left turn to go to Spain. So these guys here, this pack, were actually in very good shape if they'd carried on flying. They could possibly get back to the Spanish coast. What happened in the end was these three landed in Algeria. And Algeria was out of the competition area. And I have lots of stories about them coming in because just before they got to the Algerian coast, the wind changed. And they really couldn't get into the coast in the last 10 miles. They could see land, but they couldn't get there. And they were very worried. And I had conveyed to me some very sort of worried messages. Did I know anything about the weather there? But they talked to a weatherman eventually. And all three of them managed to land in Algeria. The only thing was they were told to land near a police station because apparently the area they were landing in Algeria was where the terrorists are and they were likely to be kidnapped as hostages. So anyway, they landed fine and all the people, locals were friendly and they didn't land near police stations and they got back okay. These guys landed there in the end and this guy landed in Sardinia and he had to land because he wasn't allowed to fly VFR over Italy at night. So he ended up landing there. Anyway, the rest of the pack's here, and I'm just there. So, and that was the final thing. And the bottom there is a picture of Algeria when they landed in Algeria. So, and landing in Minorca is another story as well, because it's got very small fields, and it's got a very big mountain before, as they came in, so they had to go over the mountain, then descend quickly to get into that island. And they had lots of bruises on them. So we're now on Monday, 8 o'clock, sunrise. We're still over the sea. We're only doing 5 to 10 knots. We're crawling along. It's 24 hours since we last saw land, 33 hours of flying. We're skirting the Spanish coast just off Barcelona. We did a wonderful flight right round the Barcelona airspace. And the controller really wasn't bothered about us because we were just 1 mile outside his airspace all the time. And at one point, I thought I was going to go in there. So he got hold of him. He said, "Oh, don't worry about it." So, midnight on Sunday, the tracks want us more to the west. So I think you saw from that previous track. So finally, this is on the Monday, later on in the day, we see land in sight. And you can see it sort of got a bit cloudy and that sort of thing. And at the time, there were some wonderful thunderstorms going on in mainland Spain, because you're talking about September, it's still warm over there. And we're nearly there, but we're still, and I keep on thinking, is that wind going to change? I didn't realize it changed for the other guys, but. And eventually, about after 32 hours over the sea, 41 hours of flying, we came back into the Spanish coast. We had a little bit of a problem here trying to find the wind fly through the night, so I nearly landed because I really wasn't going to play around at 5 knots in a sort of wind at night, trying to get over the Spanish mountains that we were going to go through. But eventually we did get the right wind. We went up high. And the problem with going up high, there was a band that was going back out to sea. And of course, you didn't want to do that. And in gas balloon, you don't want to experiment too much because we're trying to do this competitively. So if we flow out sand to go up to test it and it's not there, then we have to valve to come down again. But we found out that we talked to our MET guys and we were told the band would be at 6,000 feet. And fortunately, it was. So, just more pretty pictures of the coast coming into Spain, and I'd quite like to have gone to the beaches here, but. And there we are, we've made the decision to carry on flying, so this is now Monday night. We've been flying since Saturday, going inland into the hills, and this is a picture of the hills. And again, it's not easy terrain to land in, so you don't want to have an emergency over there, so you have to be very clear when you go into that night that you've made the decision to carry on. And just some more pretty pictures. Thunderhead dissipating, we could see it in the distance, so it was dissipating, so I was happy. I did check whether the next day the forecast had any thunder happening, and they said not before 2 or 3 o'clock, they thought it would be fairly stable. So it meant that if we did need to land in the morning, we should be fine, theoretically. Spanish mountains, 6,000 feet, we were at 6,000 feet. The mountains were, we ended up having to go higher because I think some of the mountains were higher than that. And the weather's beginning to settle, so. Sunset on the Monday evening, just views from the balloon. And of course, you're in this peaceful balloon, there's no sound. It's no burner, nothing. It's just absolutely amazing. And that's just to show you how the race is progressing. There's one which was in, this guy did get to come into, this is the Americans. And then this is the pack coming in here, and we're just a bit north of here. We didn't quite go fast enough in that Rhone Valley to get those. That's me sleeping, just so I put that one in, so I can sleep okay. Put in a picture of a cow. The reason we put in the picture of a cow was because I saw him on the way back, and the cowbells, during the night, you could hear the cowbells, absolutely amazing. You know, sat in the balloon hearing the cowbells and the church bells, the church clock, so. This is sunrise, the next day, 7 o'clock. On the YouTube video, it shows this cloud just sort of streaming over here, absolutely beautiful. 56 hours of flying. You wouldn't want to be anywhere else, absolutely amazing. We've gone up to 9,000, 10,000 feet by this stage for various reasons. And there's Anne with the oxygen. We can use nasal cannulas or you can use an actual mask. We're trying out both just in case we decide to go higher. That's to show you what the basket looks like after 2 days of living in it with some of our stuff stuck around. So. We also had a satellite phone so we could talk to the people on our ground. The satellite phone works some of the time. Your mobile phone doesn't tend to work when you're at that altitude. So this is us, and they're just showing where we've got to now, which is this star down here. And I got a text message on my mobile phone to say that if we carried on, then we might get a woman's world record. And I'd gone in for this race not to get a world record, but to try and win the Gordon Bennett. And So we're flying and we're thinking, okay, well, that'd be nice to get, but let's just concentrate on getting a good flight and continuing. And this is just the air map, just to show you this. There's a lake here, and in the next slide, I think we see the lake. So that's the lake which was on the map, and that's where we are. It's got a nice dam, and again, on YouTube video, there was a town, I think, on the next Oxbow Lake, just down there. It's just very pretty. We don't have to do anything. Balloon's flying itself, and we're just avoiding the danger areas because we're going into a danger area. Oh, the Jefferson maps tell you there's a danger area there, but they don't tell you what the danger is. So I found, and the GPS doesn't either. So, so we had to phone up somebody to find out exactly what the danger area was. Solar panels, there were masses of solar panels. And then this happened at midday, which was an F-18 fly past. And apparently our air traffic control had told, the race control had told the Spanish military or somebody, that because they were good pals or something, that there were two lone females in the air, and they really should go and have a look at them. And of course, with Latin blood, they came round. And this fly past was absolutely incredible. The noise of that jet in the basket, you just, to this day, I took some photographs on, I took a video camera with me, and the jet didn't look very close in that at all, because of course it was a wide-angled lens, whereas this photograph shows probably a bit more realistically how close that actual jet was, and it was just absolutely incredible. So this flew past us, and so we knew we got the world record, so that was great. And there is a clip of this, but I think I'll skip it and come back to it. Spanish windmills, getting towards the end of the flight now. We flew over Don Quixote-type windmills. You could see them very well from the air, but I didn't take any pictures, so this is the ground picture. We went back to have a look at them. Just nice countryside, lots of vineyards, lots of olive groves, and easy landing now in the middle of the day. We're out of those hills. Anne's very fair-skinned, so she found it really difficult. She found the night really easy. It wasn't too cold for her, but the day was the hardest part for her. So she was too hot in the Spanish sun. So, notice the handbag there, by the way. Well, we're flying along, and I'm going to go through the next night. I fully intended to go through the Tuesday night, but unfortunately what happened was that we'd been throwing out quite a lot of sand to compensate for the night cooling. And just as the sun was setting, I decided that to get over the mountain range we were approaching, we'd got something like 80 kilos of sand left, which should be more than enough to go through the night, but I was still using it to compensate for the nighttime cooling. And I'd also have to go up to 8,000 feet to clear this range of mountains. So very last moment, having decided to go in through the night, told everybody we were going through the night, I changed my mind. But I'm a woman, so I can do that. And we came down and landed immediately. And fortunately, I landed just before this range of hills and in a very, very good field. It was a fantastic field. And that's the landing. The basket's there. Again, on the YouTube video, you can see it. It's more daylight. When you land the balloon, and unfortunately, I can't show you the landing because, of course, I'm busy doing it. And it was a last-minute decision to do it. So, and it was a great field. It was very long. And we came over two quite big villages. And everybody in the village was following us. It was fantastic as we came in, approached over a railway line and over a major road and landed the other side in this field, which must have been about 2 or 3 kilometers long. And there were some black cows in the very end of the field, which I didn't worry about because they were miles away. They really were a long way away. And I wanted to be near a road so we could get easy access. The landing was I would say, perfect because we didn't, I don't know if you'd call like greasing in, a bit like an aeroplane equivalent where you just sort of just come in and the basket just slows down very carefully. We had about 15 knots on landing, but it didn't feel like that at all. And we threw what we call a trail rope out, and that helps a lot as well. So the only thing was with the landing is I did the perfect landing, stood up, but I also pulled this parachute line, which I wasn't particularly familiar with. And of course, it went a bit too much hydrogen for my liking. So of course, the final bit was a thud because I'd vented it just a bit too hard. But we're happily down after 69 hours and 22 minutes of flying. And I got out the balloon, and the thing was I nearly fell over because I hadn't realized that I'd been stuck in this balloon and basket, which had obviously been moving. And the ground was flat and solid, and it was a bit like seasickness. I was just found it very difficult to stand up. Anne didn't have any problems, but for the next 3 days, I had real problems walking upstairs and anything like that. So. And that's us. The farmer was wonderful. He was out there immediately, and he came and bought us a beer. He came and bought us Spanish chorizo and things like that. So that's where we've landed. It's just south of Madrid, south of Toledo in Toledo. So, and that was a farmer. He was happy. We went and gave him a bottle of whiskey, so that was good. And that's, some people ask me what it is, but that's the trailer, and that's it all packed up and back in the trailer. We packed it up that evening, just put it in, and then repacked it the next day. The only problem with that field was that those nice black cows in the field, of course, being Spain, weren't cows. They were bulls, which is why the farmer came out, because he said they're bulls. So anyway, we packed up in the dark. The bulls didn't bother us at all. If they'd been cows, they would have been all over the envelope. The bulls really were not bothered. And because the farmer was there, we were perfectly safe. So. But we did go back the next day to take a picture of them. We were very lucky. We found we'd landed at sort of, I think it was about 8:30 in the evening. And by the time these guys followed us, the two guys there, well, they didn't really follow us. They went on holiday in different places of Spain, actually, because we were 32 hours over the sea. So they just went to some nice resort in the mountains, apparently. And anyway, to cut long story short, we found this great place to go that evening. We turned up at something like stupid, like 11 o'clock at night in Casa Rural, and we got given this wonderful reception by the owner. So we stayed there for 2 nights in the end. And of course, you had to have paella, so they cooked us paella. And the next day, we didn't fly through that night, this decision. The next day, at 6 o'clock, well, 6:20 UTC, everybody else has landed. So the one that was doing that sneaky thing down here is the American balloon. He landed here. The Swiss balloon has come and landed here. Yeah, I was going to say, look, he did a night landing. The French is still flying. So this is the day next. We've decided not to fly, and I guess we could have flown, but anyway, the French are still flying. And what I want to show you is the French landed just there. And so what you've got every taking off from Geneva. You've got one in Sardinia, three in Algeria, two in Mallorca. This is Hempelman Adams. I beat Hempelman Adams. The French and another American balloon. And then you've got these three that have gone the furthest possible distance you could go in this particular race, given the boundaries of the competition area, landing with just over, I don't know, 50 to 100 kilometers from each other. So when you say balloons can't be controlled, there is a degree of control. So we ended up coming sixth in the end, landing there. So because it's Anne's second time in a gas balloon, I think we're going to compete this year and better that score, I guess. The rest of them were all men. And there was a female co-pilot in the American balloon down here. But it's just fantastic. These guys, the Lay brothers, there's a French pilot called the Lay brothers. They won the Gordon Bennett 3 years running. And one of them is retired now, but his brother was flying in this balloon. So they're just very good at it. And so that's the thing. That's Anne and I at the end of the... with all our kit taken at the Casa Rural and first aid kit and everything. And this is the trail rope, which we throw out just there. That was the cartoon that appeared in the local paper when I first started doing the Gordon Bennett gas balloon race. And if you're interested to see it, it's a 10-minute video, but it goes quite quickly. If you look on YouTube and put in gas balloon world record or women's balloon flight, it should come up with it. So, I'll just finish with that one, really. When you fly with a male guest balloon pilot, male balloon pilot, you can do that for ballasting. So, and that's when I went to Canada. So, thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Named Lecture Series. Find more from this series and other events at aerosocietychannel.com. Need to gain exposure in the aerospace community? Gain involvement and exposure here on the Aero Society Channel. Contact the Royal Aeronautical Society to find out more. Visit www.aerosociety.com to make contact. This presentation was brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPAmedia. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.